The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
I was the most surprised person in the courtroom when Big Tobacco came up to me and asked me if I was the person they should make a settlement offer to.
Steve Urid talks about the $13 billion plus settlement from the Big Tobacco companies to Florida's taxpayers, and about the time he didn't think he would live to see another day.
I was at Georgetown for less than 2 weeks when I was under one of those anti-crime lights, and a heroin addict stuck a gun in my face and told me to get in the car.
And about how his career success of hundreds of multi-million dollar verdicts and settlements has come at a great personal price.
It cost me a marriage, at least one. It's cost me sometimes my health. I become extremely agitated, irritable.
Plus, his views on the future of the legal profession.
At the end of the day, money really doesn't mean much. I mean, I've been without it, and I've been with it, and it's a universal solvent. It dissolves character, integrity, honesty, families. It dissolves most anything strong that I rely on and believe in.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. Barely in his 40s at the time, Steve Urid was the youngest member of the so-called Dream Team of Florida lawyers who took on Big Tobacco in the mid-1990s and won. The idea to add racketeering and conspiracy charges, tripling the potential damages that could be awarded, contributed to the tobacco company's $13 billion settlement to reimburse Florida state Medicaid costs for ailing smokers. Steve is still fighting Big Tobacco, helping to win a $15 million jury verdict against R.J. Reynolds in 2017. But there is so much more to Tampa's Steve Urid than one single case. They include his long-shot, act of God defense that exonerated the harbor pilot whose ship struck the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, leading to its deadly collapse. In all, he's won more than 250 verdicts and settlements of $1 million or more, several record-setting. Along the way, he's been honored with the Florida Justice Association's Perry Nichols Award, our highest honor. He's also a lifetime member of the prestigious Inner Circle of Advocates, an invitation-only group of the best 100 trial lawyers in America. He's on the Board of Governors of the Fellows of the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers. And he is a key contributor to the endowment fund of the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, our charitable entity. Steve Urid sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in February 2018 and revealed his one key to courtroom success, words of wisdom that have proven true along the way, and his advice to other lawyers on how to avoid letting trial law get the better of you.
Steve, you were one of the lawyers representing the state of Florida against the big tobacco companies in the mid-1990s to recoup tobacco losses from Medicaid treatment to smokers, adding racketeering and conspiracy charges against the tobacco companies, $13-plus billion settlement.
Well, the new executives in charge of the tobacco companies that had never lost since the 1950s needed motivation to be included in the group of black hats that we had assembled and proven existed in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, because that gave them skin in the game. Judge Cohen was kind enough to allow us to amend and add those two counts, both the conspiracy to engage in a racketeering enterprise and also the engagement in the racketeering enterprise. Two or more acts, easy to find, because tobacco was guilty of a hell of a lot more than two or more. I was the youngest person on what we call the Dream Team. Bob had asked me to take over the settlement negotiations. So you can imagine, to give you an offshoot of that, after we added the racketeering and we were in the third week of jury selection, I was the most surprised person in the courtroom when Big Tobacco came up to me and asked me if I was the person they should make a settlement offer to. And I said I wasn't, that Bob Montgomery was the leader of the team. Bob, Shelley, and I were the ones in the courtroom picking the jury. I was watching. They were picking. So I conveyed the settlement offer, but only after a misunderstanding. The defense lawyer with Ed Moss's firm said, I thought, my hearing was bad then, it's really bad now, but I thought he said $3 million. I said, $3 million? Don't be ridiculous. I have more than that personally in the case, and, you know, it's, hey, that's chump change. And the guy looked at me like I had shot Abraham Lincoln, and I said, what are you trying to insult me for? He said, I don't think $3 billion is an insult. I said, did you say billion? And, of course, I had to keep my composure and act like it was not a big deal. And he said, yeah, $3 billion. I said, well, that's different. I'll take that to the client. And I walked away. And that night, we were at the Brazilian court. They were staying at the Breakers, the Tobacco Armada, I called them. There were hundreds. When I say hundreds, there was one hearing when there were three of us, and I counted 128 of them. Not to give you an idea of the odds.
128 lawyers on the other
128.
Side?
128. They had a lot more than that back at the hotel, but that was just one particular hearing. I think it might have been the RICO amendment. But in any event, and all the news media in the world were there, CNN, all the major networks, Fox News, all of them. So the bottom line was, we're back to the Brazilian court. I always called Governor Childs, Senator Childs, because I'd known him since he was a freshman senator. And I said, Senator, they've made a settlement offer, the first one, I think, in their history. They've offered $3 billion to settle the case. And he looked, I thought he looked at me. I will always think he looked at me up until this very moment. But evidently, Bob was seated beside me. Evidently, Bob thought Lawton Childs was looking at him, because he said, turn that crap down. We can get more. My heart, after it stopped beating in my throat, and my guts were able to settle down just a little bit, Childs redirected his focus again on me, and he said, what do you think, Steve? And I said, what was I going to say? Bob was a leader. I said, I agree with him. Well, that, I think, was on a Tuesday night. Whatever night it was, I didn't sleep. So the next morning, we got to the courtroom. It was 9:15 before the proceeding started. I informed the defense that we respectfully declined their offer. They said, is there a counteroffer? I said, no. And from 9:15 till about 1:30, I was vomiting, but it was nothing was coming out. You know, I had that sick feeling, but I was nauseated. And then the weight of the world was lifted from my shoulders when about 1:30, they offered $4 billion. And so now my turning down $3 billion didn't seem so monumental, but we were living on horse flesh by that time. We were trying to take a siege mentality, and we were really flying. It was bubble gum and rubber bands, trust me. In any event, the next day it went to 5, the day after that 6, and 7, and 8. Then I left to put my son in school, and I was the only one that left town. So that weekend, they settled for the $13 billion figure. And I arrived on Monday morning to hear not only the announcement of the settlement, but also to hear Governor Childs and Attorney General Butterworth saying that one of the best aspects of the settlement would be that they wouldn't have to pay attorney's fees. Now I was even sicker than I was when I turned down the $3 billion, because I heard it right twice. We ended up having to litigate against the state of Florida. Much like the Crusaders coming back from the Middle East, we thought the King's Army was there to greet us in all their shiny armor. We were all scarred up, bloodied, and halfway alive from the Crusades, right? Fighting on behalf of the King. And we landed on the shore only to find out the King's Army wasn't there to greet us. It was there to kill us. So we had to fight another battle, yet another battle, to get our well-deserved and well-earned fee.
Right.
And ultimately, we went to arbitration. We took the arbitration award, and it's a good thing, because the Florida Supreme Court invalidated our fee agreement, saying only the legislature could appropriate money, and it was an appropriations of sorts. So they dishonored our contract.
Wow.
A little too late, because we accepted the arbitration award, which was very close to the 25% of the settlement.
Most notable case of your career so far?
Oh, I don't know about the most notable case. It was one of the more noteworthy cases. I think in 1980, when I defended the pilot that hit the Sunshine Skyway Bridge and knocked it down, that was probably something that was more of an impression. I was 30 years old, and the world thought we were going to lose. Not well, with the exception of my mother, the world. So my mom said I could do anything in her eyes, which may have been true in her eyes, but I didn't think it was realistic. And my defense of an act of God, meaning nothing humanly possible would have changed the outcome of the course of events, was successful, actually. So I got my picture in the paper all over the world. That catapulted me into, I'd had a couple big verdicts before that, but in my 20s, but that catapulted my career. And then I had a number of cases that I was able to help families, and those were all noteworthy. So to help the state of Florida was really a great experience.
And so many, many multi-million dollar verdicts and settlements to your credit. I mean, among them, a 2006 case, a $217 million jury verdict in what was at the time the largest medical malpractice award in Florida history.
No, it still is.
Wow.
I think that one's not going to be broken. There are a lot of records that get broken, but I don't think that one's going to be broken.
Now, you came from very humble roots, though, didn't you?
I did, but I had a hero. I had my mother. My mother was a single parent who, at 7 years of age, I had to kind of occupy a different role than I would have liked. I had to be kind of the man of the house, but what a lady of the house I had. She was my hero and continues to be my hero. She gave me invaluable assets, invaluable traits. I learned survival skills at a very early age. I miss a normal childhood, but you know, I heard one time that we heal strongest in the broken places, and clearly I didn't want to come from a broken home. Back then it was a lot different than it is now. But my mother was absolutely gorgeous, and she made choices that I just now begin to comprehend were very difficult choices. She chose me over many, many opportunities she had as a very young and very beautiful woman. She could have easily jettisoned the responsibilities sometimes that she had. She never once did it. She did one modeling job. There was a beer, Carling Black Label beer. Mm-hmm. One of our stops during the divorce trek was Pittsburgh. We lived in a number of places, but Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And she got this job modeling, and it put extra money on the table because she had a secretary's salary to otherwise feed us. My dad didn't at that time provide any child support for a number of years. We reunited, and I forgave him a long time later. But in any event, my mother used to often tell me she had to keep her girlish figure so she didn't eat. And it wasn't until much later I found out that she didn't have enough money sometimes to feed us both. So
wow.
That had a remarkable effect on me.
But you made it to Georgetown University School of Law.
I've never made anything anywhere that was close to success without the help of other people. And the only reason I was at Georgetown Law School was because my father worked for the Post and Catherine Graham really, really liked me. And I became a friend of hers when I was a young boy. She decided I should go to Georgetown Law School. So she called up her former general counsel, Adrian Fisher, and said, "Put this boy in law school there, Butch. He'll make a great lawyer." That was in June. I got in the August term on probation. And I had to suffer through that first semester knowing if I didn't do well, I was going to get kicked out of school. And fortunately, I did okay.
It seems like your life has been a series of trials by fire.
My life has been a series of people giving me breaks and believing in me when I didn't believe in myself. And I've succeeded only with the help of others. I have failed all by myself.
What made you want to be a lawyer?
To make a difference. I think the law is a wonderful thing. I think without the law, you know, Shakespeare said that famous phrase, first we kill the lawyers. But people forget the first part of the phrase. If we're to have anarchy and chaos, first we kill the lawyers. You see, that's the first part of the
I've sentence. Never heard that.
Yes. And so if you want total chaos and you want anarchy and you want unlawful behavior, which is unacceptable behavior, then first get rid of the lawyers in the system of justice.
So it's really a lesson on the rule of law.
It really is a lesson that's been taught well as far as I'm concerned, because I've seen the law do amazing things. When the courtroom makes a difference, when all else fails, the legislators, the special interest group, the regulators, even presidents in the White House and senators and representatives who we think can actually make things right, when they've failed, it's been the courtroom that's made the difference, and they have failed miserably in some areas.
What was it growing up, lessons that you learned that prepared you or that has guided you in your career so far?
That people that don't have often lose even when they're right, and people that have, and I'm talking about money and material power and wealth, and influence. People that have that have always got the upper hand. And it's rare when champions of justice, that's what I call our trial lawyer bar, when champions of justice have the resources and the ability, and frankly, the intestinal fortitude to stand up against insurmountable odds simply because they're right and they believe in a cause and they're willing to pay any price in trying to make that cause come true, then I believe that I wrote a book once, and the original title was Justice Prevails. And I talked to the publisher, and I said, I can't author that book. That title is not acceptable. And she was very, very kind. She was a New York publisher, and I was fortunate enough to have them publish the book. But I said, that title just doesn't work. She said, what does work? I said, you got to put the word when in there, because having justice often depends on who you are and what resources you have, not whether you're right or wrong or whether you deserve to win. And that's a flaw in the system. Luckily, you know, I don't meet defendants that can outspend me. And usually they can only put one gunslinger in the street, and I'm fine with that. They can put 10 in the street for all I care. You know, my gun still comes out of the holster pretty fast.
You'll take them on.
Well.
How did you go about honing your trial skills?
I don't know. Irving Younger, an old lawyer that was very, very good at talking, very, very good at seminars. I don't know how good a lawyer he was in the courtroom. I don't think he was a real practitioner. But he once said, if you go in a nursery, you can look at the kids in the crib, in the little nursery crib, and you can see them. And the ones that are going to be trial lawyers have a big T on their forehead. You just sometimes can't see it. I really think it's an inherent asset, because the people I see that are really, really great at what I've dedicated my professional life in doing, really great trial lawyers, I think are born with it. I certainly didn't earn it, and I certainly maybe don't deserve it, but I can tell you, when I walk into a courtroom, some really unbelievably good things have happened, and I don't take any credit for that.
Is it any one skill, though? Can you put your finger on it, what the key to your success is?
Telling the truth in a simplistic, understandable, common sense sort of way, and talking to people like they're in your living room. Not talking down to people, not talking up to people, not using fancy terms, no matter the communication skills required, but capsulizing those communication skills in a simple and direct approach that defies anyone to come to another conclusion other than the one that you seek them to conclude. That is, you have a just cause with just clients, and for justice to occur.
Was there a point that you didn't think you were going to make it? Either professionally or personally?
I was at Georgetown for less than 2 weeks when I was under one of those anti-crime lights, and a heroin addict stuck a gun in my face and told me to get in the car. So that night, I didn't think I was going to make it. I drove around with a gun in the back of my head for 3 hours. That night, I didn't think I was going to make it.
How in the world did you get out of that?
A lot of talking, and then he was nodding off, and ultimately, I asked if I could see his gun, and he was high enough to let me. So once I grabbed it, things changed dramatically in terms of who had the gun and who was the victim and who was the prey. Mm-hmm. Who's a predator. But that's just one. And I've had a lot of those. I got in a very bad car accident, and I was in danger of not making it. And, you know, I had a pretty violent childhood and was in more than a few scrapes. But I survived it, and I think I'm better for it. The things I learned that I survived, I think, have been my greatest skill set. They compose my best assets. They also have hardened me and made it difficult for me to give up on anything I really believe in. I think they've made me, I don't think the word relentless is a good word, but I think totally devoted. I mean, when I take on something, I don't leave anything behind. I put everything I've got into it, everything.
Tell us about the role ego plays in being a good lawyer.
Well, ego is, in my opinion, the worst enemy a human being has. I think ego is a driving force of confidence. I think it can be a good armor wear, if you will, for harsh times. I can get through it. It provides some insulation. But the word we is so much more powerful than the word I. And I think part of getting older has taught me that I really can't do very much. The ego really is grossly overestimated in terms of being an asset. I think it's underestimated in terms of being an enemy. I think the best people I know are humble. I teach at Georgetown, and I've taught there for a decade. And I tell the young students there something that I found to be a truism. If you pick the right client and the right cause, most of the time you just have to get out of the way and not screw it up. And it'll win all by itself.
How helpful or hurtful can self-reflection be?
Always good. I think it's always good to be self-reflective. I think it's always good to have input either from self-reflection or from other people, because being inside the bubble sometimes makes us believe that that's the only way to do things.
Tell me, how do you handle disappointment?
Well, I can tell you that the only way I handle defeat, I can't accept defeat. So the only way I tolerate defeat, I have lost 7 times in the courtroom, and I remember those much more vividly than any of the multitude of cases I've been fortunate enough to prevail in trying. I want to win almost as much as I want my next breath, not because of my own ego. My track record's pretty good. I've got all the statistics. My body of work, I'm very, very comfortable with my body of work over the course of 40 years. No, it's not that. It's letting down the people I represent. So the only way that I can even tolerate that instance is to know that I have done everything I could possibly do, that I could not have tried any harder than I tried. I could not have prepared any more than I prepared. And I still fell short. Well, that at least allows me to say, I couldn't have tried any more. I couldn't have done any more. Now, some other more gifted lawyer may be able to win those cases I've lost. But I know in those cases I've lost, under the circumstances that prevailed, got to let it go.
You've been involved with the Florida Justice Association for a long time. You're a very generous supporter of the FJA. How has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
Well, I happen to think that that organization's invaluable to our way of life. I think that the Florida Justice Association, previously the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers, the organization itself is a veteran of many, many worthy battles. It is a veteran of defending many, many worthy causes and notions and opposing some draconian measures that would, in effect, cause a decay in our individual rights and liberties. It's the organization, really, that stands between us and the ability of people to get justice. They are our buffer. That organization protects us against bad legislation. It protects us against bad forces of evil that seek to deprive people of due process and rightful access to the courts. And what I found, amazingly, the people that benefit, some of the people that benefit the most, come up short when they're asked to support the organization. I never understood that. I mean, careers are bettered because of that organization's efforts. My career has been bettered. I believe I joined the organization in 76. It was one of the first things I did. It might have been 75. One of the first things I did, because I said, what's the most effective, most well-equipped organization that I can find in the state of Florida to further the interests of justice? And I came upon the Academy, now the FJA. I joined it. I've never looked back. The Academy has done far more for me, the Florida Justice Association, than I could ever do for it. So to become a supporter, enthusiastic supporter, was easy. Being able to become a significant monetary supporter was a little bit more time consuming because I had to put myself in a position to give meaningful money. But I feel that I've given my share, and I think I'm approaching $1 million here soon. I imagine before I turn it in, I'll hit that number, because certainly it's a $1 million organization.
For those young and coming attorneys listening to this podcast, what words of wisdom have proven true to you along your spectacular career?
Never stop trying. Always believe in justice and the cause that you represent. Always know the people that you're representing and know that their hearts are pure and their cause is just. And then be the best you can be by listening to those that have succeeded, by taking ideas that have worked, and then putting your own personal individual style. You know, it's hard enough to try a case, but it's really hard to be an actor. So I choose to try a case as myself, and I choose to take on the cause of truth. Because one thing I've learned, I may not be a good actor, but I'm me. I may not be great at selling an idea, but the truth sells itself.
This is a tough profession with lots of demands. How do you balance your professional life with your family life?
Well, I haven't done it very well. To be blunt, you know, if I have some advice, all advice is not necessarily, oh, look what I did so well. Some of the most sage advice, some of the most insightful advice that a person can give to another is often based upon failure and shortcomings. So what I can tell you from personal experience, that personal lives suffer doing what we do. The stress, the burden, the long hours, the unbelievable strains, and just the dynamics of the profession. Much like a gunslinger, you're only as good as your last fight. It cost me a marriage, at least one. It's cost me sometimes my health. I become extremely agitated, irritable. I remember winning a case once and becoming extremely depressed because the challenge was so great. The aftermath was, where's the challenge? It just, all the air went out of the room, and instead of the exhilaration, it actually was a time of depression for me until I rose up again because it took everything out of me. I mean, I had everything left. I remember I usually lose 3 pounds a week in trial, and I remember that particular trial lost 18 pounds. I think the trial was only 4 weeks, however, but I went above my 3 pounds a week.
Wow.
But it was a lot. So addiction, when I say addiction, alcoholism, stress, marital discord, neuroses, all those things, those come with the territory. So it doesn't mean that you have to go that way. It just means that that exposure is there. And if you know that, you have to safeguard against that. You have to eat well. You have to learn to sleep well. You have to learn to put things in perspective. And most of all, you got to take it one day at a time.
What are your regrets?
Oh, hell, if I had it to do all over again, I'd probably come back as a trial lawyer and probably make every damn mistake I've made. You know, I'm the type of person that only learns the hard way. Don't touch that stove, it'll burn you. You can believe I'm going to get a burned hand. I mean, I think that that's probably okay as long as I can say I've learned from my mistakes. And by and large, have I learned from them all? No, but I've learned from most of them. I don't like burned hands, and I don't like to make mistakes, especially when it costs other people. But if I had it to do all over again, I'm pretty sure I would have done it the same way.
What's your view on the future of the legal profession?
Do you have concerns? Oh, yeah. I'm worried about it. I'm worried, very worried about the paucity of jury trials, the scarcity of just that constitutional right to have disputes settled by a jury of your peers. Those are all threatened. I think it's an evolution of practice because with alternative dispute resolutions, to accept the notion that the system is almost irreparably broken. I mean, for people to go through 6, 7, 8, 10 years to get litigation done, for people to have what are called litigators basically give them thousands, tens of thousands, in the tobacco case, millions of documents to just overload a litigant. That's the style. If jury trials disappear as they are fast doing, I see a system that I don't want to be engaged in. I see a world that I don't really want to contemplate because I don't see a place for me in that world. It's almost like being the last of the Jedi Knights. I mean, I can't have the Death Star win. And God knows there are a lot of people that follow that Death Star these days. I mean, hate, separation, acrimony, just really almost a personal dislike in politics has so divided this country now that instead of being Americans, we're a particular type of American. And instead of being able to work for solutions through compromise, we wage war where the only thing that's left is destruction and damage. I mean, no one wins in that type of environment. And that's what and the technology age scares the hell out of me too, because it used to be in my lifetime, I said photocopy machines are going to be our death knell. We're never going to be able to get out of these damn faxes. And then it was, well, you know, we're never really going to be able to get away from this electronic age. And then e-filing came. So you can't even get away. You know, at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, you could lock your door and at least go home with the worries. Now, you lock your door, you go home with your cell phone, and you get served with something at 5 minutes till 12 midnight. So there's no rest for the weary, no matter how weary you become. And I don't like the lack of personal relationships, the lack of interfacing, the lack of, for example, me looking at you during this interview, what would I be talking into a machine? I don't think so. I don't think I could share my soul with a machine. And I see that as becoming a world that's less personable, a world that's less warm, a world that has less love in it, a world that has just less humanness in it. I mean, that's the world I crave. The world I crave is the embracing world, where you meet and you truly meet in an embrace, in a warmth and a friendship that endures a lifetime. Now it's almost, what can you do for me? What can you do for me? Young lawyers, we get job applications here by the drove, but I'm always interested in a lawyer that wants to tell me what they can do for us, as opposed to what can your firm do for me? When we make hires, I often like to ask the question, what are you going to do to advance the law? What contribution do you, if you could make one contribution, what would it be? Mm-hmm. As opposed to, oh, here's your starting salary and here's what we give out in bonuses. I mean, at the end of the day, money really doesn't mean much. I mean, I've been without it and I've been with it, and it's a universal solvent. It dissolves character, integrity, honesty, families. It dissolves most anything strong that I rely on and believe in. So I've had a life without money. I've had a life with money. The life with money makes getting happy a little easier. It's hard to get happy when you don't have a full stomach. It's hard to get happy when you don't have a roof over your head. But at some point in time, just a modicum amount of money gives you the ability to truly understand what's important in life. And that's giving back, being grateful, being inspired, and having abilities that are given, not earned, but abilities that allow a person like me to help many, many others along this path that I've chosen. And if I had one wish at the end of my life, it's when I close my eyes for the last time, I can say I made a difference.
We've talked about the law. Let's talk ethics. Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
No. That's an easy one. When I chaired the board certification committee for the Florida Bar, I made ethics mandatory. There were 7 sections. You could pass 6 sections, but if you failed ethics, you failed the exam. You weren't board certified. I don't believe unethical lawyers, they can't be trial lawyers. In fact, they shouldn't be lawyers.
Steve, how would you like to be remembered?
I'd prefer not to be remembered. I'd prefer to stick around. But if I had to be remembered, I would want to be remembered as someone that always tried their best for the betterment of others. That's how I'd want to be remembered. And I know that the only way I can face my end, personal beliefs aside and spirituality aside, the only way I can face my end is to know that really some of the ripples that I hoped I created, some of the people that I gave them some of their life back, some of the children I've made their futures more secure when their parents have been killed, some of those ripples are going to turn into tsunamis. I mean, I think that there's going to be some real differences made by the people I've been able to help, because they're always going to remember that someone helped them. And people that get helped, they got a tendency to help others. So I think it's a good thing to pass it on, or pay it forward, as I believe the phrase is. So I hope I paid it forward enough. I'm going to keep trying until my last breath, simply because it makes me feel so damn good.
Steve Yeard, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.